This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Charles Manson, one of the most notorious murderers of the 20th century, died yesterday at the age of 83 in a hospital in Kern County, California, after spending most of his life behind bars. He has remained perhaps the most iconic, most enigmatic cult leaders in the modern American imagination. You can join us. Are you old enough to remember when Charles Manson and his gang burst into the headlines? If you're too young to remember those dark days, what does Charles Manson mean to you now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Fort Worth, Texas is Jeff Gwynn, author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Hi, nice to be your guest.
Well, thank you for being here. Remind us of Charles Manson and the grisly killing spree in Los Angeles in August 1969.
Manson has remained famous, or maybe notorious is the better word, ever since the Tate-LaBianca murders in August 1969. There was another murder that preceded them, another one afterward, making 9 victims total. Because Manson is such a master of manipulating the media and the public, he's managed to stay, unfortunately, relevant all these years, to the point where now, for many younger people, he's sort of an iconic figure, a cool rebel, when in fact he was a blue-collar, murderous, sociopathic thug. But Manson always bragged he was the man of 1,000 hats. He could appear to be all kinds of different things without any real effort at all. And sadly, when you look at the attention even his death is bringing, he succeeded in what he wanted most, which was getting attention.
So Charles Manson was a semi-literate, habitual criminal, the wide-eyed leader of the Manson family. Tell us about this murderous band of young drifters that carried out these murders.
They sound much worse than they should have been. Manson, at his height of powers, could never attract and keep more than a couple dozen drug-addled young followers, almost all of them with issues with their families and part of that late 60s brigade of kids who were wandering America trying to find some guru who would tell them what to do and how to do it. Manson gradually, because he was a gifted demagogue, separated them from their family, any friends they had, preached his own twisted gospel, which included a coming race war where the blacks would eliminate the whites, but Manson and his followers would ultimately emerge to rule the world. And if that sounds kind of far out, remember how many drugs they were taking at the time. That was also part of Manson's.
Let me play this clip from a 1973 documentary. This is Charles Manson describing the family, quote-unquote, that he had as outcasts who made their own reality.
The people you call my family were people that you didn't want, children that were alongside the road that their parents had kicked out. So I took them to my garbage dump and fed them and taught them that in love there's no wrong. Everything they've done for love of brother.
He literally rode around in a ramshackle bus, Jeff Gwynn, sought out converts. Explain the hold he had on his followers.
What Manson was skillful at doing was finding young people in particular with very little self-respect who were alienated from the world, who'd pretty much been the kids who were always ignored, and explained to them that they were special, that he was the one who loved them, and they should leave their blood relations and join a real family. The famous school bus, when they drove all around parts of the country supposedly exploring, was really Manson's way of getting them away from any outside influences. Again, we shouldn't ascribe to Charles Manson something any more than he was. Before he got into the murder business, he was a fairly unsuccessful pimp, but he used the same techniques that pimps use to get a string of young women. Find the ones with no self-esteem and make them feel somehow beholden to you. It worked then for him in some ways, and again, it worked to murderous effect later on with young kids.
Let me get Wade in here from Burnsville, North Carolina. Hi, Wade. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I don't think we should have kept him up all these years, or anybody similar to him that's committed murders and lived a life of crime. And they shouldn't make an excuse for drugs was his influence that made him the way he was.
So Wade makes a good point, Jeff Gwynn. Initially, Charles Manson was sentenced to death, right? What happened?
The California Supreme Court ruled that death was a cruel and unusual punishment, and Manson and the followers who'd been sentenced to death instead received life sentences. What I've always believed was that the death sentence was wrong. Anybody could always be rehabilitated, that no one was beyond being reached somehow. But after spending years studying Charles Manson's life, I've reluctantly concluded, yes, there are people, very few instances, but there are people where the death penalty would have been appropriate. Instead, Charlie had all these years since 1969 to occasionally pull some of his stunts to stay in front of the public eye and to continue to get the attention that he always craved.
The most famous of Charles Manson's victims was Sharon Tate, an actress who was married to the film director Roman Polanski. She was 8.5 months pregnant at the time. He had other high-profile victims. Remind us of the gruesome nature of his crimes.
Manson, though he didn't participate in the Tate-LaBianca murders himself, orchestrated them, though he made his followers believe that, in a sense, they were doing what they wanted to do as well as what Charlie wanted. He wanted the murders to be really horrific. He wanted the murder scenes to be disgusting in their explicitness because he wanted reporters, he wanted the media to believe that these acts were committed by black militants. It was a way, again, of, in his words, precipitating helter-skelter, the race war. That didn't work. But still, Manson thought that he would at least demonstrate to his followers that he could cause things to happen, that he was important. Look at us, the media, the newspapers, TV, they're talking about us. So everything he did, he was using other people for his own ends, and that's the classic definition of a sociopath.
And so help us understand Charles Manson in the context of the time that he lived in, the time that these murders happened, the turbulent late 60s, an era of race riots, of street protests. How did he refine his sick message, if you will, to fit those times?
There was nothing unique about Charles Manson's philosophy. He stole ideas from the Bible, from the lyrics of the Beatles, and most of all from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. There was absolutely nothing original about him. But what he did do, as any demagogue does, is to come into a moment of cultural upheaval and exaggerate even further some of the dangers, the race riots going on in major cities. He translates this, rising up, we're going to have a race war. So, again, he was a classic demagogue. He wasn't particularly talented in that. He couldn't retain most of his followers that long. But what Charles Manson was an amazingly talented public relations expert who knew how to manipulate the media, the courts, and everything else. That's why we're still talking about him all these years later.
Let's go to Joel in Wausau, Wisconsin. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call and to your guest. So I actually was one of the people, I was really interested in Helter Skelter when I was in high school, and I was interested because I thought, what is it that takes a man and makes him do this? And I'm convinced, you know, you keep talking about how you wanted attention, and I think that's, as I understand it, is another one.
Oh, dear. Joel, we're losing your line. Call back if you can. From my notes here, I see that that you believe from your study of Charles Manson that he really had no childhood. His mother was a teenage prostitute, and he was in the system, really, Jeff Gwynn, at a very early age. Tell us about this early life of Charles Manson, who was very troubled.
A lot of it was completely made up by Manson himself. His mother was not a teenage prostitute, though she did go to prison for theft at one point when Charlie was five. But he was part of a loving family that took him in. He was never on his own. He made everything sound much worse than it was, trying to present himself as a victim. In fact, there's times as a child, he would attack other people. He was fascinated with knives. In school, he would organize kids to beat up other kids he didn't like, and then when he got in trouble, would tell the principal, it wasn't me, they were doing what they wanted to do. And all those years later, that was his defense in Tate LaBianca. There is no reason to feel sorry for him because he had a terrible childhood. He was responsible for everything he did.
He was charming, and he was terrifying. There were two sides to him, were there not?
There were many sides to Manson. He could charm anyone he wanted to, but the real depth of his character was frightening, not in that he was insane. He was never crazy. The scariest thing about Charles Manson was that he was coldly calculating. As Leslie Van Houten, one of the convicted killers who talked to me for the book, said, nothing Charlie did was ever spontaneous. It was always part of a plot. There's no reason to feel sorry for Manson, and I think the worst thing about him was that he knew what he was doing the whole time.
5 years ago, Charles Manson was denied parole. At his hearing, California Parole Board member John Peck quoted a statement that Charles Manson made to a prison psychologist. Here's that.
I am special. I am not like the average inmate. I have put five people in the grave. I've been in prison most of my life. I am a very dangerous man. And this panel agrees with that statement.
Jeff Gwynn, in fact, several of Manson's followers went before the parole board asking to be released. Have any of them been released?
The problem for them is that no California governor wants to be the one who is nailed by the media for pardoning a Manson family killer. The parole boards have occasionally recommended that Manson followers be released. Governors have yet to approve that. I don't think they ever will.
Here's Donna in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. Hi, Donna. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Yes, the Manson murders happened just as I was celebrating my 21st birthday. I was absolutely horrified. And ever since then, whenever I hear the song Helter Skelter, I just go crazy because I was a huge Beatles fan being that age. And I feel that in some way his legend has been romanticized. I'm not a person that believes in the death penalty in most cases, but because they let him live and speak from time to time, I feel that they perpetuated this so-called legend, and I'm glad that he's passed on.
Donna, thank you. Jeff Gwynn, it's a great point. Has his legend been romanticized by his frequent appearances on television and at these parole board hearings?
Definitely. In some sense, we can sort of consider him a criminal Kardashian. He knew how to play the public, and he's done it extremely well. I never believed in the death penalty until I started researching Charles Manson. And the more I learned about him, the more I found myself changing my opinion. That was a hard thing for me to do, but this is a man who never once in his life did anything of benefit to anyone else other than himself.
The Manson family has occupied a dark, persistent place, as we've heard, as Donna mentioned, in American culture and American commerce, Jeff Gwynn. I mean, talk about things that he's inspired, pop songs and opera, films, a host of internet fan sites, T-shirts, many nonfiction books, most famously Helter Skelter.
And even a phone ringtone of some of his really terrible music, if you'd like that. Again, Manson understood how to manipulate not just individuals, but the public at large. He was a small-time demagogue who got all kinds of publicity that kind of pushed him forward. If he'd been paroled at any point, he just would have gone on to do something even worse because he would have wanted more and more attention. The money part, pardon the expression, pissed him off because he wasn't making any of it. Up till the day he died, he was trying to sell his art to fans who wrote into him, and his art would consist of pictures of spiders, swastikas, and the words Helter Skelter, usually misspelled.
Has there been an answer to the question of his mental health issues? Was he a sociopath, a paranoid schizophrenic? Any answers?
I believe after I talked to all kinds of professionals who study this kind of thing and then took their conclusions to the people who've known Manson, I believe, yes, he was a sociopath. But when we hear that term, we shouldn't interpret it as someone who's insane and doesn't know what he's doing. Manson always knew what he was doing. That's the frightening thing about him.
Charlie Rose interviewed Charles Manson and asked him if he felt remorse. Remind us of his answer and how he felt about those murders, about his legacy all these years later.
Well, Manson would always say that he didn't need to feel remorseful because he didn't do it. The other people were doing what they wanted to do. Again, sociopaths don't feel remorse. Manson, throughout his life, thought he deserved to have anything he wanted and couldn't be blamed for anything he did. If you look for remorse in those people, you're wasting your time. Ultimately, Manson was, in a very horrible way, a success. He did what he wanted to do. He became known and became influential. In that sense, he was powerful. The world's a better place without him.
Charles Manson, one of the most notorious murderers of the 20th century, dead at the age of 83. Jeff Gwynn is author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. He joins me from Fort Worth, Texas. Jeff, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.